Continue in our study in Matthew 19, Mark chapter 10. We've been going very slowly in this section because we've been addressing a wide variety of other topics that are raised here, specifically Jesus' teaching on marriage, creation, male and female, obviously very directly related to much of what is happening in our society, the redefinition of marriage, homosexuality, and things like that. And hopefully some of that somewhat digression and expansion has been of some assistance to you. We continue on with the assertion made by the Lord, "Have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, the two shall become one flesh. They are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder." They said to him, "Why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away?" He said to them, "For your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for unchastity, and marries another, commits adultery." And the disciples said to him, "If such is the case of a man with his wife, it is not expedient to marry." But he said to them, "Not all men can receive this saying, but only those to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who have been made so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by men. There are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He who is able to receive this, let him receive it." Now, we had gotten through to verse 7 in Mark 10, verse 5 in Mark 19, same text. We had seen the fact that male and female is a part of God's creative decree. It is not merely the just happens to be the way that blind, non-teleological, teleological being having a purpose or goal or direction, the non-teleological activities of natural selection working upon random mutation happen to end up favoring mammals and a male-female sexual orientation situation. That is the only meaningful foundation for a naturalistic materialist to look at male and female roles. There can be nothing transcendent to that. For the person who really believes what they have been taught in our educational system today, the only reason a man's a man is purely genetic and purely fortuitous and purely by chance. There is no transcendent meaning to your maleness, to being a man. There's no transcendent meaning to your femaleness and being a woman. Motherhood just happens to be a biological function. Fatherhood, for most men, is just the result of certain actions, nothing more. You can't, no matter what people come up with, and people will. It's amazing to listen to naturalistic materialists who believe that all that exists is what you can see and touch and taste and feel and measure on a electronic piece of equipment. Who really do believe that we are just the random, pure luck result of natural processes. They still have to try to come up with explanations for what they feel when they are married, if they even bother with the formalities, for what they feel if they're a man when their wife becomes pregnant, or what the woman feels when she feels that life within her. They have to come up with something, but it has no direct connection to their worldview. They're demonstrating, they're creating the image of God, they know better than this, but their worldview just, it cannot provide a foundation. There is no made male and female. It's just, well, male and female happens to be the route that branch of evolutionary development took, and that's it. You can't go beyond that. And I think that's something that needs to be pressed upon people who you see many a modern-day liberal who loves art, loves music, and has absolutely positively no reason for so doing. What is the evolutionary advantage of music? There is none. Well, it could lower your blood pressure. Oh, okay. Well, that's only relevant. And even at that, that would not actually be a properly evolutionary response. Because that's only relevant as to how long you live. How long you live is irrelevant. From the evolutionary perspective, all that matters is that up through childbearing years, especially for a guy, as long as you can father kids, then father kids. Father with as many women as possible. That's the evolutionary perspective. It really is. I mean, they are trying desperately to come up with moral systems based upon evolutionary thought. And it is hilarious to watch them violating their own biological principles because they know they have to do it to try to explain why we behave the way we behave. It's just not, you can't do it. But for anyone who really understands how the evolutionary theory works, even the lowering blood pressure thing wouldn't be relevant because vast majority of young men do not die in their 20s from blood pressure issues. So that would be irrelevant. And same thing with women. So there's no answer for that. It's just, well, it gives us pleasure. If it doesn't increase your genetic footprint in the next generation, it's irrelevant. And you can make up anything you want to explain your behavior. You're acting inconsistently with your worldview. But all of them do. All of them do. It was ironic, since she's here this morning, Summer and I had the same biology professor in high school. I guess he wasn't a professor, he was a teacher. But anyway, the same biology teacher in high school. I had him the first or second, actually I think the first year he started teaching, and she had him the last year he was teaching. So we sort of managed to catch him on both ends. And so I learned, he and I would, I remember my sophomore year in high school, we would sit out in the little area there at Independence High School where you could buy these, man, I still remember what they looked like and what they tasted like, these absolutely horrible burritos. I mean, they were just, I don't know what they were filled with, but I'm not even sure it was organic. But anyway, you'd get them in these little cardboard box things, you know, and we'd sit out there, and he and I would argue about evolution. And he would photocopy articles out of science journals and stuff like that because I was an advanced student and blah, 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 and didn't get to be in high school and all that sort of stuff. And so I learned, college-level presentation of neo-Darwinian micromutational evolutionary theory in high school and fought that battle for years. And what he really drove home was the non-teleological nature of natural selection. There is no goal. When you see those trees and this leads this, this leads this, our minds say, well, the goal was to get here. No, it's just the way it was. There's no purpose. Teleology, end. Teleos means end in Greek. So teleology is that there's a purpose, a goal, an end. There is no end. We just happen to be what we are from the evolutionary perspective. And I'm very thankful that I learned evolutionary theory on a deep level because I went to a Christian college and all my professors at the Christian college and biology department were evolutionists. So I thought I was going to get to stop fighting that battle once I got out of the public schools, but it was not the case. And I continued to fight that battle as a biology major, completing my biology major as department fellow in anatomy and physiology, and was given a choice of taking my BS or my BA. I should have taken the BS. They just called me on the phone one day, woke me up from a nap. Which one do you want? It's like, well, I could have really used some time to think about that. It would have been a whole lot easier to go back and finish up the extra credits you needed to get both degrees and get the BA than go back and get the BS. But anyway, I really had to delve into the evolutionary theory and thankfully understand it quite well. And hence the developments that have happened over the past 10 years have been fascinating. The mapping of the human genome, for example, has just thrown the whole field into a tizzy. because the whole methodology of micro-mutational evolutionary theory, it was before they mapped the genome. You know, when I say they mapped the genome, does everyone understand what I'm talking about? You've not heard of this. Over the past 6-7 years, you've had this finished up recently. They did it a lot faster than expected to. Because of our advances in technological understanding, we have been able to go through the entire the sets of chromosomes in the human species and identify what each section of the DNA molecule is coding for. See, the DNA molecule, the double helix, is this incredible microcomputer that contains multiple libraries of information in every single cell in your body. It's just absolutely amazing. We don't have anything come even close to it as yet. Even if we ever do, all it will demonstrate is it took a whole lot of intelligence to get around to that point. But anyway, and we know that all the structures in your body, all the proteins and enzymes and everything that regulates the hundreds of millions and literally billions of chemical reactions taking place in your body every minute, that all of that comes from what is coded in the DNA molecule. And so what they've been able to go through is identify exactly what all the base pairs, cyanine, guanine, thymine, et cetera, and what they code for, and are able to figure out, okay, this section on this chromosome, this particular section codes for this protein, and this codes for this protein, et cetera, et cetera. And so they've mapped the human genome, which they thought would answer all of our questions as to how we work and everything else. Well, it certainly has led to advances in understanding in many areas, but the one thing that it has really done is thrown a monkey wrench into the majority of naturalistic theories as to how in the world we got here. Because while we've mapped it, it doesn't answer the vast majority of our questions. It doesn't tell us how in the world the cell knows use an example we could figure out fairly easily. As most of you know, I do a lot of writing. I'm doing much more writing than I've ever done before. I sort of look like I'm doing much more writing than I've ever done before. I'm getting back to the way I looked back in the 90s. And I'm on pace for right now I'm on pace for 8,400 miles this year. I'm not going to make that, but anyway. One of the things I want to do before I do a ultra marathon ride in October, 185 miles in one day, is to go up to Flagstaff. Why would I want to go up to Flagstaff for a few days the week before or earlier in the week of the day I do that ride? What's the altitude? Who cares? What's that? 7,000 feet up there. So what? More red blood cells. Why in the world would I get more red blood cells if I go to Flagstaff? Do they sell them on the street corner? They do sell them on the street corner. Okay, good. All right. I'm looking. There's less oxygen. Okay. But how in the world does my body know there's less oxygen? I don't even know. I mean, I've got my iPad. My iPad doesn't tell me there's less oxygen up here. See, my body does know. My body is able to tell by the amount of oxygen coming into the bloodstream when it starts falling each time I breathe. And so my body initially begins to respond to that by making me breathe faster because it takes time to build red blood cells. Red blood cells are the mechanisms whereby oxygen is carried to the various organs of my body and the tissues of my body. But it takes time to build them. And so when you go to Flagstaff and you decide to go up a hill to go take some pictures of some pretty flowers, you get to the top of the hill, you're like, man, I thought I was in better shape than this. Well, actually, if you were down in Phoenix, you wouldn't be going, because we're at 1,200 feet here, and there's much more oxygen there at 1,200 feet than there is at 7,200 feet. A number of months ago, I rode my bicycle to the top of Mount Lemmon. Mount Lemmon tops out at 8,300 feet. And when I got to the top of Mount Lemmon, I was breathing hard, not only because I just
climb 6,711 feet on a bicycle over 26 miles, but because it's at 8,300 feet. And then I went, and that worked a lot better because I had just been in Denver for a number of days. And it made sure to ride real hard in Denver, because where's Denver at? 5,280 feet, et cetera, et cetera. Your body senses these things, and over time, creates more red blood cells to carry more oxygen based upon your normal breathing rate. Well, how does it know that? How do the cells in your body know, okay, we need the building blocks of red blood cells, because red blood cells have to have specific chemicals in them to grab hold of and hold on to oxygen, but not so hard that it won't then release the oxygen to your tissues when it gets into the tissues and your tissues need the oxygen. And the only reason your tissues need the oxygen is because of a whole different, extremely complex system of chemical reactions that allow you to live. I mean, the complexity of this stuff, to me, whenever I hear, I was just listening to this atheist I'm going to be debating at the end of August. He's the vice president of the American Atheists, you know, Madeline Murray Harris Group. They're the most radical of the radicals. They're the quite nasty atheists. And I was listening to him, and just the religious dogmatic fervor of this man for evolution is identical to the most King James-only fundamentalist Baptist I've ever met. There's no difference between the thought process of the two. None. Cannot be questioned. If you're a rational person, you'd never question this. And every time I hear that, I just chuckle in light of what I know about the biological processes of our body. And if by the way, I wasn't going to get into all of this, or I would have brought up my computer and showed you all sorts of neat stuff, fun stuff, but if you're really interested in a good introduction to this, an understandable introduction to this, the book came out, it's older now, but it's still excellent. Called Darwin's Black Box by Michael Behe. And it goes through the incredible complexity, informational complexity, designed complexity. A person has to turn their mind off to not see the design. What's going on in your body right now makes this thing look like a stick and a rock. And this is my droid. And if anybody knows droids, they're pretty interesting little pieces of equipment. And this isn't anywhere near capable of doing what's going on in your body right now. You could tell me this just happened to evolve over billions of years? Don't think so. Little Korean guys made this. They know. They're very proud of it. So, yes, sir. Well, their standard response to that is, well, you're presenting the God of the gaps. You're presenting the God of the gaps. What they mean by that is, it used to be that when mankind was scientifically ignorant, he would attribute to God everything that we did not understand. So lightning is Thor in heaven throwing lightning bolts at unsuspecting human beings who hide in all the wrong places. Now we understand exactly how lightning works. And so God's no longer needed to throw lightning bolts. And so from their perspective, the role of God used to be real big in mankind. Now it's really small. And all you're saying is, well, we're going back all the way to the beginning. And, well, where did that original, the super heavy particle that gives rise to the theories of what's it called? The God particles. I just was talking with somebody about this week, actually. There is an article about how an old particle divider may have discovered the what's called the God particle they've been looking for quite some time. This that they theorize gives rise to the original particles, et cetera, et cetera. And so they will say, we don't yet know, but we have faith that science will find out. And once we do, you have no place left for God, because God has no more reason to exist. That's the mindset of the consistent naturalist materialist, Darwinian evolutionary hypothesizer. Anyway, getting back to where we're going here, and I, again, I just wasn't expecting to do this, but it is fascinating to me. Somehow the proper message gets through to the cells in your body that are responsible for the production of red blood cells. And as you may know, those are in the marrow of your bones. Neat place to carry stuff. They are told, okay, you need to start cranking out more because your body's producing them all the time because they get destroyed in various processes. You bleed, et cetera, et cetera. They get old. They break down. And so you're having to produce a certain number of red blood cells normally. But then when you go up to Flagstaff for a few days, that process kicks in of creating more red blood cells. Well, how do they do that? Well, there has to be all sorts of systems. Your body has to be bringing in the proper nutrients, transporting the proper nutrients to the proper tissues. But all of it comes down to, eventually, the coding for the complex molecules, and they have to be very complex because most of the reactions that take place in your body are due to a molecule, and I can't really do this with my hands, but having a certain shape that fits into another shape. So if you've got, if you're one atom off, it doesn't work anymore. Enzymes, for example, incredibly complex things. Far more complex than the keys that we use to open our doors. You know how the keys have certain ridges. Well, an enzyme's far more complex than that. And so there has to be an exact coding in an exact sequence to create each of the enzymes and each of the proteins necessary for constructing anything, whether it's brain tissue, heart tissue, whatever. The digestive enzymes that you use in your stomach to eat your lunch coming up in a few hours, all those things are extremely specific, and they're all coded for in the DNA molecule. But the thing is, how in the world does that teeny, tiny little cell know to start doing this, and these smaller molecules, rRNA, tRNA, messenger RNA, they go in and they unzip. It's a double helix, so they unzip it in the middle at the exact spot where you need to start and start creating a mirror image. And it only goes as far as it needs to go to the very end of that particular thing you need, and then it stops and re-zips the thing up again. And then takes the mirror image out, connects it to a ribosome, like a negative photograph, and it connects it to a ribosome, and the necessary components are attached to it in a row, and off comes the enzyme or the protein that you need, and then it's transported out into the cell and into making what you do. You're sitting here looking at me like, there's no way that's happening in my body. Yes, it's exactly what's happening in your body. And to say that all happened randomly. No design means that you get your Gmail on your phone randomly. Nobody designed that. It just happened. And isn't it great? It's just absurd to me. So that's what I mean when they talk about for a long time, what we thought was that you would just change one, you'd have what's called a micromutation. See, what happens is, the reason that we're supposed to have, and it looks like Brother Ed forgot this, supposed to have sunscreen on our heads when we go out in the sun, yes, or hats.
I've heard that.
You've heard that, good, all right. Let's use Brother Ed, since he's already red anyways, he can't get embarrassed. So the sun comes down on Brother Ed's head. Where were you at a golf thing or something? San Francisco. The sun still comes out in San Francisco. Even amongst all these strange people, the sun still comes out in San Francisco. So solar radiation comes down in the form of ultraviolet light and starts cooking Brother Ed's skin. And eventually what happens is some of that high energy coming from the sun that made it through the thinning protective layer of the atmosphere, ha ha ha, comes down and enters into one of his skin cells and hits the DNA molecule. And it causes corruption. It causes a mutation. That's what cancer is a mutation to where it changes what the cell produces, and normally what ends up happening is it starts producing cells that just keep reproducing themselves and poisoning the body, et cetera, et cetera. So those little mutations, 99% of the time, are deleterious. They'll kill the cell, they'll kill the host, they'll whatever, because it's damage, and the damage is bad. All the evolutionary theory runs on the idea that, yeah, but 0.001% of the time or so, it won't necessarily kill you. Oh, great. And so the idea is you can come up with these positive mutations, and let's say that Brother Ed gets a positive mutation from his experience in the sun in San Francisco that results in his ability to run like the wind. He's going to outrun, what's that guy from Jamaica? That's Thunderbolt or Bolt? Is that his last name? Thunderbolt or whatever the guy's name is. All right. And all of a sudden, Brother Ed finds himself the world record holder in the 100 and 200 meter dash because he's gotten this new mutation that has just made him uber fast. Well, the idea is then you pass that on to the next generation. Oops, that's probably not going to happen now, but let's say that it did. You pass that on to the next generation, and that spreads across, because now, I mean, who could ever rob Brother Ed? If they try to rob him, he can outrun the bullet. So that means he's going to have more opportunity of having kids, and his kids are going to survive better because now their predators can't catch them, robbers, whatever. And so that becomes the new norm for the species of Ed. See, Ed becomes predominant. That's how the evolutionary theory allegedly works. There's one little problem we've discovered in mapping the human genome. Genes don't work like that. We've discovered that in some instances, you can play around with all sections, a bunch of sections of a chromosome. Won't impact what it produces at all. We've discovered that genes actually exist over entire sections now. And sometimes they're highly sensitive, sometimes they're not. And so micromutation doesn't really work the way we thought that it did. And so what that means is to make a positive change that gives you some new... I mean, think about the development of the eye. Think of all the micromutations it would have had to take to go from accidentally developing some light-sensitive chemicals to accidentally developing a way for the little brain of some little creature to understand light-sensitive chemicals and to accidentally developing lenses and accidentally putting it out on the outside of the body where it can detect light and accident, over again. It was one thing. It absolutely boggled the imagination to think of it working under the old rules. But now we realize, to do that, you've got to change not just one little thing, but a whole bunch of things all at the same time, in the same way. And then, even when that happens, what happens is that guy still gets eaten by his predator. Now you got to do it all over again. I mean, let's say Brother Ed becomes the fastest guy in the world, but he's not fast enough to get out of the way of the speeding guy in the SUV who takes him out. And now it hasn't been passed on to anybody else, so we've got to wait for somebody else to go to San Francisco and forget his sunscreen to develop this new super fast breed of human. And how many times would that have happened? It absolutely boggles the mind. The irrationality of it just makes me go, wah! And yet there are so many people standing up there in their white lab coats just telling us for certain that it's true. And I just sit there and go, man, okay, all right. That's why I said this whole thing about male and female, they have no grounding in their worldview for attaching any meaning to it. It's just simply the natural result of natural processes over an incredibly long period of time, and to read anything more into it, which they have to do because they feel love. They feel amazement at the creation of life. To be a true naturalistic materialist is to be a person who recognizes you're nothing but an animal and there is no meaning. And what a lousy life that is. I think we're seeing the result of this in European society and our own society. People who just throw their lives away. Because what does it matter? There's no meaning here. Why should I worry about leaving this world a better place for somebody else? Let me make the biggest carbon footprint in the world, because I don't care. And yet they don't even take a real naturalistic Darwinian perspective, because you'd think they'd realize I should have the most kids I possibly can to have the biggest impact on the future, because the only impact I'm going to have is a biological one. But they don't. What has been the natural result of secularism? Who cares about the family? Because, see, once you have kids, you have to take care of them. They're such a pain. So what has happened in secular societies? The number of children plummets. Why? Because you don't want the bother. I mean, if you don't have kids, man, you can, you know, most of us earn a fair amount of money. If you're not buying sneakers and taking them to the doctor, and man, just think what Mr. C would have if he hadn't had to feed these behemoths. I mean, he would live in Scottsdale and drive a Lexus just off the money on food. And so, once you stop worrying about having a family, the future, you don't worry about things like your nation, patriotism, values, none of that stuff. You just live for you. That's the only logical thing you can do. Now, I'm not saying that every naturalist materialist lives their life that way. I'm saying they're inconsistent if they don't. And I know they try to come up with answers for all this.
Well, I just think, you know, it's better to, you know, follow the golden rule.
Why does your worldview necessarily lead you to that? It doesn't. It doesn't. Now, how anybody gets that out of Matthew chapter 19, verse 5 or 4, I have no earthly idea. But hopefully it was of some at least entertainment value to you, if nothing more. But hopefully there was actually some information there for you that would that would be interesting. At this rate, we're going to fill up two more notebooks just on two verses if I keep doing this. But anyway, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. We talked about this last week. Obviously, we have here the recognition on Jesus' part of the foundational character of the family. And every time I have been asked to speak on the subject of the perversion of marriage that is taking place in European countries and in the United States in various locales in regards to the perverted expansion of the concept of marriage to two men or two women, or logically and by necessity, eventually, if the Supreme Court allows that to happen, we'll have to be including one man and three women, one woman and three men. I mean, logically, once you've opened that door, there is no logical grounds to argue against polygamy. There just isn't. You'd have to allow that to happen. And you really start wondering about one man and one dog, one man and one horse, one woman and 47 cats. I mean, are there not people that we know of who, if it was allowable, I mean, are there not people who leave millions of dollars to their pets? If the option of marrying that thing was around, something tells me that that would happen too. It is a perversion of an institution that is a creation ordinance. And this isn't just, well, the Christian view is, as if that means it's one view amongst a million absolutely equal competing views. That's how our society deals with things. What we're saying is God made every single person Christian or non-Christian, and therefore the owner's manual that came with you says a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they're no longer two, but one flesh, but therefore God is joined together, let no man put asunder. We've all heard that in the old Anglican-created prayer book wedding ceremony. What God hath joined, let no man put asunder. And yet, what that means is, this is the basis upon which you say that marriage and its nature, its form, is not under the authority of the civil magistrate. Because it does not say what man has joined together. Let no man put asunder. It says what God has joined together. Let no man put asunder. In other words, there is divine elements because it is a part of the divine purpose. And I would suggest to you that's why the corruption of marriage, the interruption of marriage, the destruction of marriage is so painful to everyone who has experienced it, because it speaks to our very created nature as creatures. Once we lost in our society the view of marriage as a divine act, therefore it could be entered into lightly and easily, and then exited out of in the same way. Just ask the folks who live about 4.5 hours that way, with their little wedding chapels along the strip. And so the degradation of marriage has come from, very clearly, a collapse in having a Christian worldview. Even though many people in the society were not Christians, you can be raised with the elements of a Christian worldview. You'll rebel against them, you may not like them, but you can be raised with a Christian worldview. And when people say that this was a Christian country, that's the only way you can put it that way. There's always been non-Christians. There were non-Christian founding fathers that didn't want this to be a quote-unquote Christian nation, all the rest of that stuff. But the fact of the matter is, the prevailing view in the society was based upon Judeo-Christian thought and a Christian worldview. You can't read the founding documents outside of that context. It's just, it requires a postmodern deconstructionist mindset where you don't have to worry about original context, which is now what we're dealing with. So there was a recognition of God's presence. Remember what else was a part of that old Anglican wedding format? Before God and these witnesses, it was assumed that God was present in a special way when marriage takes place. And that the vows being exchanged were being exchanged before God and these witnesses. God the more important of the two. But, the witnesses were not unimportant. Even today, you're supposed to have witnesses. Now, it's just for the rather blah reason that, well, we need to make sure this really happened. For legal purposes, just like you have to have somebody to notarize something. But the witnesses originally functioned much in a much more important way, in that these witnesses, to make vows in front of other people, there used to be this thing, and I know it's almost like smallpox or measles. We've gotten rid of these things in our modern world, but there used to be something called shame. Now, for younger folks, I need to spell that. It's S-H-A-M-E. And it's an old-fashioned concept that a person would blush and would have an elevation of their heart rate and would lower their heads and would feel separated from the group of society because of their behavior. What it required is that people would actually believe that there was good and bad behavior and that there were some things you do that would bring shame. And we've gotten rid of that. Interestingly enough, the only people that are now using that term that I know of, have you noticed this?
The homosexuals. The homosexuals. Did you see the video last year of the Christians in San Francisco? But it was dark. That was an advantage they had over you, Ed. It was dark, so they didn't get sunburned. But they were in a bad area, and the cops had to form a cordon around them to get them out of that bad area. And between the four-letter words that were being used regularly, the thing that amazed me, and the same thing happened, remember the little old lady back when Prop 8 was being voted on, who walked into the middle of a demonstration with a cross in her hand? They knocked the cross out of her hand, stamped on the cross, knocked her around. Little old lady. And what were they chanting? Same thing they were chanting to those Christians when the cops were dragging them out of San Francisco. Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on you! Now, why do you think they're doing that? Because they feel it all the time themselves. And when they get together with other people who feel it all the time, they want to project it onto somebody else, onto the people who remind them of their own shame. I suggest that's the only reason they're using the term, because the rest of us can't get to use it at all. Very quickly, because we've got 1 minute. Oh, I didn't know the unions. Oh, I've missed that. Okay, well. That sort of ruins my entire illustration, actually. Thank you very much. Somebody hit him. Shame on you. Those witnesses were there, and it functioned as a buffer. It functioned as a wall that you did not want to stand in front of your peers and break the vows you made in front of them. There was something about my word and my integrity that's now, who cares? I mean, let's face it, in Western society, who cares? It just doesn't matter anymore. So anyway, I'm not sure that you actually have to move the marker at all in your notes, but we will continue on. We will get through this section if I will just stop going off into other areas. Hopefully that you're not sitting there going, yeah, I wish you hadn't done that. Hopefully there was something useful in the information that I shared with you. So let's close the word of prayer. Our gracious Heavenly Father, once again, we do thank you for this time. And we do ask that you would make us to be ready to give an answer for the hope that's within us, within a dark and adulterous generation that has been caused to close its own eyes to its own nature. May we be lights, and yet may we recognize that if we are lights, there will be those who seek to put out our light. And so give us boldness and give us confidence in doing your will, we pray in Christ's name.